Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
Daniel Kaufman is currently chief advisor at the Natural Resource Governance Institute after having served as president and CEO from 2013 to 2020. He's also currently a member of the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative International Board and serves in various international advisory boards, including the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, Secretary General's High-Level Advisory Group on Anti-Corruption and Integrity, the Inter-American Development Bank's President High-Level Advisory Group on Transparency, and at the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. His research on economic development, governance, the unofficial economy, investment, corruption, privatization, and urban and labor economics has been published in leading journals. In research, policy, and media circles, he's associated with innovations such as the Worldwide Governance Indicators, the Resource Governance Index, and the study and analysis of legal corruption and state capture. Daniel is a Chilean national who received his MA and PhD in economics at Harvard and a BA in economics and statistics from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Daniel, it is great to have you on the podcast today. You and I first met nearly 20 years ago when, as a director of the World Bank and a leading authority on issues of corruption, you were a frequent participant at the World Economic Forum's Davos annual meeting. At the time, you had just launched the Worldwide Governance Indicators, a key early attempt at developing metrics that shifted the nature of the debate on corruption to evidence-based analysis of internationally comparable composite indicators. It seemed to many of us at the time that this was a sensible way to direct attention to issues of governance without interfering with domestic politics. To get the discussion started, Daniel, why is corruption so corrosive to economic and human development?
Thanks, Augusto, and it's an honor to be in this podcast collaborating with you and with all the people listening, of which I know that are many, many of the young. So let me unpack and bundle your question into three different dimensions, which in many ways follows an important evolution over time. The first would be the old times, since the early to the mid-1990s, I would say, when we started measuring corruption and governance, which was associated at the time with traditional notions of corruption and bribery. The enormous cost of such traditional forms of corruption and bribery we found back then is still relevant nowadays. In brief, we found there, as a rough estimate, which about 2% of GDP was going in briberies around the world, unevenly distributed in different countries. And we can elaborate on that later, because the actual cost of corruption, in fact, we found at the time and then since then, was much higher and much broader. One homework we did was regarding the upside. What happens when you reduce corruption? Well, on average, that leads to a tripling in incomes per capita. It leads to huge differences in domestic and foreign investment increases, and in a two-thirds reduction in infant mortality, and in billions and billions of development aid waste, which is avoided. But then let's move quickly to the second phase. As we were approaching the 2000s, the new millennia, we focus on an insidious type of corruption at a much higher level, high-level corruption or grand corruption, which was associated either with kleptocratic heads of state, autocratic heads of state, which were very highly corrupt, and still many of them are, or with state capture, where powerful oligarchs or corporate interests capture the legal and regulatory framework. We can discuss that also later, but that causes a major undermining of the key institutions of the state, of the country, the police, the military, the intelligence services being infiltrated, and the economy itself. And this is also associated with threats to national and internal security, and very importantly, with democracy and human rights violations. And that evidence has been increasing too. And finally, the third dimension, let's fast forward to our era, the current era. And one way of summarizing it is we can call it the health challenge era, and two dimensions here, even if other factors also matter. But we have found that countries more afflicted by corruption have been faring very poorly with COVID in all dimensions. And also those corruption-prone countries have been prone to see an increase in poverty. But then there's another very important health dimension we need to bring in very early in our discussion, which we can elaborate, Augusto, and that's the health of our planet. Corrupt interests associated with perverse incentives have been a major obstacle to the urgently needed energy transition and addressing the climate crisis by decarbonizing. So let me stop there. To continue this discussion, but I thought it was important to give this trajectory over time and the evolution of this issue of assessing what are the major costs and consequences of corruption, which has evolved over time.
Thank you, Daniel, for those thoughtful remarks. Let me follow up and ask the following. One issue which was preoccupied those who recognize the harmful effects of corruption is what are some of the options open to governments wishing to reduce corruption and mitigate its effects? I remember reading a piece by Susan Rose Ackerman, one of the leading academics on the subject, where she argued that two-pronged strategy aimed at increasing the benefits of being honest and the costs of being corrupt, a kind of a combination of reward and punishment as the driving force of reforms, was perhaps the best approach. In terms of your own experience, you have been working on these issues for a long, long time. You have advised governments and so on. What are some of the initiatives or measures that have worked or that are most promising to deal with an issue that seems to be out of control in many parts of the world?
This is obviously an ongoing debate and discussion, and there's no one answer. And the reason there's no one answer, it's first because we all have to be humble. Obviously, there have been some successes, but also many failures, and the problem persists. But the other dimension here, Augusto, is that there is no one Bible or manual in this area. And this is because there's no one size that fits all. We need to deal with both dimensions of space and time, where there's enormous variation across both of those dimensions, space or countries, and even within countries. There are enormous differences regarding not just the extent of corruption, but the main determinants and manifestations, which is why we invested in developing diagnostic tools which countries or cities themselves could carry out to get a rigorous understanding of the causes or the manifestation and consequences of corruption within their own context, within their own settings. In some countries, the judiciary is totally corrupt and captured, so it is at the core of the problem. In others, it is a relative island of independence and integrity, in which case it can be part of the solution. And it can start there, the a program against corruption. Furthermore, the main challenges evolve, morph over time, even within the same country. So there's no escape of doing the homework at each context and its setting. So at a general level, as a multi-step approach, and very simply and briefly, I would put on the table, first, one needs to translate the demand for anti-corruption from different stakeholders in a country into a commitment to work together to diagnose and implement the program. And you mentioned in the question, what do we do with governments? But this has evolved, Augusto. Today, it has to be multi-stakeholder for it to work, including, of course, government, but civil society, industry, media, the investors, the youth. Second, it's very important, the diagnostic itself, which we mentioned, with the involvement of experts, think tanks, civil society within the country. Third, a national participatory forum to identify the key areas for an anti-corruption strategy. Fourth, an empowered working groups prepare an action program in a multi-stakeholder fashion. And then government with the support from civil society, industry, adopt and implement. And this is not just talking academically. We have done that in the past, and we have worked to facilitate this process, which was from the country itself in countries like Georgia, Latvia, Colombia, Peru, after Fujimori, number of countries in Africa, others in Latin America. Some implemented more than others. Nothing is perfect, but it's to illustrate. Let me finish by also emphasizing that one has to look at the number of potentially vulnerable areas and do the risk analysis and the diagnostic for those areas in a country. Financial sector is typically one, the budget, public investment, public finance, what we call public finance public financial management is another area, procurement, contracting, military security and intelligence agencies in another area, real estate construction, political high-level capture, we discuss it, natural resources, social sector, education and health, environmental and issues, and the nexus with the private sector. Now, this is a list, and as I said, which one will require particular attention will be part of the contextual diagnostic that will throw out what are the three or four major priorities to start working with in an anti-corruption program.
Thank you, Daniel. I find those comments, very, very interesting and thoughtful, and they sort of lead me to my next question. I wanted to ask you about two potential sources of corruption and whether you would agree with the prescribed solution. One of them concerns the presence of red tape and excessive regulations, requiring citizens to acquire multiple certificates and licenses for routine interactions with the state. I'm referring to certificates to open up a new business, to register property, and so on. And as you know, in many countries, this sort of red tape has metamorphosed into potential sources of economic rents, sort of attracting or luring officials into corruption and illegality. Is the solution here perhaps simply to eliminate as many needless regulations as is compatible with safeguarding sort of the essential functions of the state? The second has to do with energy subsidies, which, as you know, are vast in scale. The figures from the IMF, which are being updated from time to time, suggest that energy subsidies are in excess of 6% of world GNP. They accelerate climate change. They are regressive because the benefits tend to be concentrated on the upper income groups and so on. If you could just comment on these two sort of sources of corruption and what we could do about them.
I can be brief here because I would say yes and yes to to both of you. You have asked the question and suggested an approach. So absolutely yes, on both counts. So let me just elaborate a little bit. On the regulatory aspect, absolutely yes, in terms of unnecessary red tape and excessive regulations, they need to be addressed. We need to be mindful that this is not just a technical exercise, because the regulations, the excessive regulations are there for a reason, typically because some people enrich themselves. So the politics are very important of how do you address that and do regulatory reform. Second, the aim is not zero regulation, but optimal or effective and efficient regulatory framework. The financial sector, the environmental sector, environmental considerations, they do require regulation, but they can be smart, they can be lean, they can be incentive-based, and so on. And the excessive red tape is absolutely not necessary. On your point on the energy subsidies and that very good IMF report on that, that's absolutely spot on, and that's a major priority ahead. And if that's not addressed, that first perpetuates many vested interests, corrupt and capturing interests, and second, it also slows down the needed energy transition, and therefore addressing the urgent climate crisis. But again, two considerations here. One, in phasing out these subsidies, it's very important to have a smart policy package that compensates the most vulnerable people. You're absolutely right that on average, these are regressive subsidies that benefit most on the richer, to the richer parts of the population, but also many poorer people benefit directly, although in terms of economic growth and corruption and so on, it hurts them eventually. So one needs to find other ways which might much more effective to compensate for that and do it perhaps gradually in some cases and so on. But the second and most important thing is the other phase of subsidies. It's the implicit subsidies. It's the tax, basically, the tax avoidance and tax rebates, even that the oil companies have been getting in huge amounts, especially during the bailout times, during the pandemic, because of their power, the lobbying power and so on, which is absolutely no justification for that. And it goes exactly against anti-corruption and the energy transition. So I would expand even the issue of these direct subsidies to cover the whole public financial, the public finance framework, and address the major problem of major oil companies and transnational that are not paying their due in taxes and getting all kinds of breaks and then even bailout subsidies when it's not warranted in this era of energy transition.
I'm going to shift gears a little bit, Daniel, and I'm going to go back into the past and remind you that you and I collaborated closely during my tenure as chief economist at the World Economic Forum. And I remember an article that you published in one of our reports in which you demolished some of the myths, as you call them, that often frame the debate around issues of corruption. I'm referring to, for instance, that corruption could not be measured, that governments could do better than be obsessed with issues of anti-corruption, that corruption control was a luxury that only rich countries could afford, or that corruption was purely a public sector problem, and so on. Can you tell us or share with us how the debate has evolved? And which of these myths, if any, would you revisit, you know, more than a decade later?
Well, that's That's a nice trip to the past and question, and I would probably revisit most of them. Many may still be relevant, but in informal English lingo, nowadays we may say that corruption and governance can be measured and so on. So they have become a bit more obvious. So if they would look as creating just an artificial straw man to do that. I would not necessarily have put in the priority list some specific one on the international financial institution and on donors, since the landscape has changed so much. And nowadays, there are so many other crucial actors, including NGOs, civil society, think tanks, investors, the youth, that just focusing on international financial institutions, which at least two of them miss, I did. I may not spend that much time on that. But more importantly, perhaps, I would put more emphasis nowadays in rejecting the notion that the most of the focus should be on administrative, bureaucratic, or petty corruption. Instead, putting much more emphasis that it's needed on grand corruption and what we have called state capture, first. And second, which is related, the transnational dimension of corruption, including through multinationals, the case of, what happened with Odebrecht in Lava Jato and Petrobras in Brazil that crossed many nations and cost basically the positions of a number of heads of state and then more. And also I would put more emphasis on specific sectors, on some new topics. So if we would have collaborated today, I would have written a different article because of that evolution over time.
Thank you, Daniel. That's very interesting. And I find myself in agreement with much of what you have said. Can I touch upon one aspect of the research that you did at that time, which is sort of a bit of the background to the IMF estimate that the annual cost of bribery is approximately $1.5 to $2 trillion, equivalent to about 2% of global GDP. And in the calculation of which you were, of course, closely involved.
Well, thanks for pointing this out, Augusto. But let me also call, at least on my side, on the need for humility on two counts. First, having developed this type of estimation would not have been possible without teamwork, and crucial teamwork was with you, because you gave us the opportunity in our collaboration, and since you not only were the chief economist of the World Economic Forum, but you headed this major and very important survey initiative of thousands and thousands of firms across over 100 countries that thanks to your work and the World Economic Forum work, and you allow me to insert very specific questions on these issues. That was a first opening that allowed me to start assessing what magnitudes we were talking about. We also developed our own diagnostics. At the time, I was working at the World Bank, and we implemented many diagnostics and other surveys where we also got a measure of bribes, both from firms and also from users of services that would tell how much people like them would have to pay for different services in different countries. So we got tens of thousands of data points, many of which we were using also for the Worldwide Governance Indicator, which you mentioned before. And out of that, basically we said, okay, what percentage then do they have to pay out of income from a very microeconomic perspective. And we aggregated and created an average of that. Of course, and that leads to the second humility. Of course, these are with strong assumptions that this was representative, and because these are basically averages based on all these surveys, although there was a lot of very rich data. And therefore, we developed a range of estimates. And I would caution against any attempt at total precision of that. So at the time, and we're talking about 2003, 2004, at the time we assessed it to be $1 trillion, which was about 2% of GDP at the time. This is 2003, almost 20 years ago, but the range was between 0.6 trillion or 600 billion and 1.5. So there was a range, but it still, as you say, was huge. Now the IMF asked me to update it, and I did. It was a very basic extrapolation to today, given our worldwide governance indicators and so on. And then they have used it. And that's where in today's dollars and in today's context, and since corruption in many countries has increased, others has decreased, or many more or less the same, we came up with this estimate of $1.5 to $2 trillion. This is for 2050. But again, one has to take it as a rough estimate first. And second, it's only about bribery. All the funds that are stolen from the budget, all the assets that are stripped and stolen in a country, and many other forms of corruption that does not involve bribery. Some of them are legal and related to capture. They obviously do not enter this calculation.
That's an interesting history, Daniel. And in 2012, I remember you penned an op-ed in Brookings titled "Rethinking the Fight Against Corruption." You argue that reshaping the fight in against corruption into a smarter strategy that integrated the challenge of improving governance and institutions in both the public and private sphere was the way forward. Can you please elaborate a little bit on that piece?
I'll be brief, but it relates to what we have discussed already, and that is the notion that comes already from my work with Joel Hellman in the late 1990s, drawing from our insights in working on the former Soviet Union and economies of transition. And the basic observation, and I'll focus on this now, that we needed to move away from traditional, to just focus and be too obsessed with traditional notions of corruption, and that's administrative, bureaucratic corruption, and focus on the middle-level public or low-level public servant, and also which was associated with the implementation of the existing rules of the game in a country, the regulations, the permits, the procurement. And we contrast that by suggesting that state capture could be much more nefarious and important, because a few actors atop the economic and political elite, they shape the rules of the game rather than just are corrupt and implement into them for their own benefit instead of the public good. Good. They shape the laws, the regulations, the policies. They shape and capture the procurement system and the key institutions to serve their own private goals. Because the system and its key institutions are captured, the costs associated with this can be orders of magnitude more than a transactional, conventional bribery in one single transaction. And that's why I give the example of what happened starting in Brazil. It's just one example, but that basically it enmeshed more than a handful of countries in Latin America through the Odebrecht, Lava Jato scandal, regarding all the procurement and contractual and other captured arrangements, including for the state oil enterprise, Petrobras in Brazil, and there are many other such. Now, oil multinationals colluding with the political leadership in Nigeria in past years is another such example. So it's a mindset that has to change in order to address this issue, which is much more political. It's not just technocratic, and it's obviously very, very difficult, and there are many vested interests that will push back against addressing that. But with that comes the importance of looking at the nexus between the private sector and the government, and not just focus on governmental corruption alone.
Let me turn the discussion in a different direction now and sort of remind you that in a recent panel in which we both participated, hosted by the Global Governance Forum and Leiden University, we talked about the need for an international anti-corruption court. What, according to you, are the top issues and obstacles to consider in evaluating and promoting such a body, given the seeming return to multilateralism by the United States and the current global governance landscape?
Let me give first a general point, which you are probably too humble to say it. And it's a general point about nowadays so important, about audacity, about persistence, and about will. And I commend you, I commend Judge Wolf and your other colleagues in this initiative, particularly in this era. Let me share with you and the audience that I'm just finishing analyzing a survey that I, with somebody else, put together in the governance field with many experts, and particularly with the focus was a bit more natural resources. But still, what we find is that there is a certain pessimism and lack of audacity among many that are involved in governance. Basically, a very technocratic, brainy approach, but not very daring. There are exceptions. But nowadays, I sense that there's such a need, because it's so scarce, to push with ambition, even or particularly when it's something is very hard. And obviously, your initiative of an international criminal court is extremely ambitious, and there are enormous vested interests against it. So, now, because of what we discussed and your question of my own work on state capture, if we take the lens of state capture and we subscribe to the reality that many settings are subject to such capture to different degrees, it means that we need to focus on the asymmetry of power and influence between the captor and the captured, and not be naive about the incentives driving those that have the power and influence of these institutions that they are shaping. So the very first issue is to look at these powerful actors that will be key members on such an initiative, International Criminal Court Initiative, and address the question, what incentive could they have and how to create an incentive for such a body to support such a body, or at least to let it exist or not. And there, I think it's important to both learn the lessons from history. So the International Criminal Court is one thing, but the International Corruption Court that you are proposing, it's in a different time nowadays and with different vested interests and so on, and adapt to those times. Now, this is very sobering, because the world has evolved so much that there will be very significant vested interests against the creation and particularly its well-functioning, but it doesn't mean that there is no way forward, and that's where your ambition and persistence is crucial. It's just not going to happen without some major tipping point, something out of the box. And you and your colleagues would know best what that could be. But in the meantime, very practically, to have some momentum and realism, I'm just wondering whether there are some complementary initiatives, and I think you are involved in some, working with some transnational, basically legal initiatives in this context, and they are the Interpols and the OECD conventions and the FCPAs and the FATF and so on, that also create a certain a consensus and power base that would support you, because there's always a bit of skepticism if it's one judge or three people trying to do one thing. So what kind of coalition you can build? And I know that you have already some countries that are interested and so on, but how to have a tipping point and get to the dozen or two dozen of countries, it's going to be extremely important. And there, I think it's important to consider that the reality today is quite different than the reality when the International Criminal Court was created, and therefore one has to adapt the strategy.
Thank you, Daniel, for those comments. The Global Governance Forum is very actively promoting the establishment of an international anti-corruption court, because we think that it is high time to bring kleptocrats to face some degree of accountability for their activities. Daniel, you are familiar with the work of John Noonan, you know, who many years ago wrote that impressive treatise on bribery, in which he said that the common good of any society consists not only in its material possessions, but in its shared ideals. And then he added, when these ideals are betrayed, as they are betrayed when bribery is practiced, the common good suffers injury. Does this mean, in your view, that in the long term, anti-corruption strategies have to be supported by moral education and the strengthening of the ethical principles underpinning society? And if so, how can this be achieved?
This is very important, but to finish, since you gave your excellent follow-up comment on the International Anti-Corruption Court and your plan ahead, my 5 cents worth, since you're going to be drafting the statutes, which I'd be very happy to review and participate, is in that context of a participatory approach to try and engage early on in the drafting already some potentially very important partners in the future on key countries, rather than being seen only from one agency or your outfit. Because in today's world, the notion of participation and feeling the ownership is just so important. It's just a suggestion, rather than then distributing already a draft and saying, please comment, are you interested? You see what I'm saying? So today, which would have been 20 years ago, but nowadays, feeling the ownership from the very first moment is very important, which you have begun to do already with some of the on some of the sessions that you have organized. Now, on John Noonan, who I esteem enormously, and your question, I would say yes and no. The notion of the ethical and moral dimension and the shared ideals is crucial. I would not narrowly translate that into only a need for for moral education. But that's where this whole notion of countries that as a society, and it's much more than education, as a culture, as a society, they strive to have a social, a collective, agreed, and equitable social compact, social contract. I mean, my own country in Chile, we are going to, a new constitution will be drafted. That's one such vehicle. So having these shared ideals is very important. Unfortunately, that's not achieved only through moral or ethical education. Second, teaching ethics and morals is very important, but I would say until age 15, max. What matters afterwards are incentives, are many, many other things. So one has to complement it. So yes, the education part is one aspect, but it has to be essentially integrated into an approach which is cultural, ethical, moral, economic, financial, legal, sociological, anthropological, as I mentioned. And it cannot just rely on ethics. People will think that they are working in an organization and there are corruption issues and everybody has to be retrained. Forget it. It's the problem is much deeper than that. It's not just sending them to training that will make the difference at age 40.
Daniel, this has been a very fruitful, very insightful, very thoughtful podcast. We have really benefited from your vast experience and very much want to thank you for it. But at the same time, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct some word to the young in particular. What do you say to people who are disheartened by the multiple evidence of corruption all over the world, particularly the young? What can you say to them not to lose hope and to maintain a positive outlook on the future?
Oh, well, some I meet are fortunately still very hopeful. But I would say, particularly to the young, I much appreciate you are asking this and raising this. Look, no, I would say to you, the young, not only the future is in your hands, the present is right now in your hands. In fact, look what is happening in the world. The top leadership in many Nordic countries, among others, are young and female. And what lesson they have taught us all on how to cope with COVID and other things. There are other young leaders in Austria. My own country, Chile, we're going to have elections in December. There's going to be, no matter who wins, a generational change towards the young, major one. It's happening in Latin America. It's happening in other places. And what are the priorities for the young? You, the young, knows it better, but obviously climate change, having health, basically health systems that function and some job prospects, professional growth, and economic growth and stability is crucial. Well, forget all of those if corruption is not tackled, which conspires against all of what we have been discussing. And the bottom line is that, yes, it can be done. The evidence on corruption around the world and on anti-corruption includes obviously major setbacks, which we have discussed, and you started with that, Augusto, but it also includes major successes of countries that used to be very highly corrupt and have managed to control it. Of course, there are temporary setbacks and continue, but there are many such examples. And for that, at this stage, the mobilization of the youth with their smarts, with the drive, with the very effective use, implementation of new social media tools is absolutely critical. With big data, with the new innovations on AI and so on. There's just so much can be done. And the health, we discussed it before, the health of the planet is right now at stake. If corruption is not tackled, there are such vested interests, including among a number of major oil companies, to continue with as almost as business as usual, in spite of their PR announcements. So the youth is crucial to be engaged on that, and hand by hand fighting corruption and addressing climate change, which go together.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.